Studying Parashiyot, Vayakel, and Pekudeh. Have a Bible. Of course, our Parashiyot are a continuation of the construction and building of the Mishkan. We are introduced once again with the builder of the Mishkan, a fellow by the name of Bezalel. But the Torah makes it a point to tell us Bezalel ben Uri ben Hur and the Matei Yehuda, Bezalel being the grandson of Hur. As was pointed out in our last Shi'ur, the Torah tells us that Hur, the grandfather of Bezalel, actually sacrificed his life for what was right, for the religion. When the band of Erev Rav came and tried to coerce Hur into acquiescing to an Egel, Hur set over my dead body. So they killed him. And as a result, Hur's Leshem Shamayim dedication and self-sacrifice merited and had to have a grandson called Bezalel. So the payback to Hur's sacrifice is to have a grandson that was given the most coveted position to lead the construction of the Mishkan. From here we learn a great lesson, that the Mishkan could not have been built just by anybody. Because they weren't looking for the most skilled worker or artisan or craftsman or the cheapest contractor and things like that. For the Mishkan to work, its origin had to be from Kiddusha. And as pure as the origin was, that's as much impact and influence the Mishkan would be able to have. Therefore, even the one that built it had to be of great fame and great righteousness and great tzidkut. I point that out because today we build synagogues. Today, you get a bunch of workers, you stand on the corner, you pick them up, you pay them $4 an hour. You don't investigate their spiritual beliefs or their askafah. A lot of them are not even Jewish. And the Gaon of Vilna is on record of saying that if they would build a synagogue from its inception with only Jews and only on days that you're allowed to work, and the money that they collected for it is all from the kosher funding, and all the materials come from kosher sources, he said it would be impossible to lose your concentration in the Amidah in such a synagogue. Which means the synagogue would be so kadosh that it would you couldn't make a mistake in that place. But if we find today that we're not able to have such levels because even our Kiddushah has been diluted and has been compromised. There's a Gemara that says, in the name of Rabbi Hayya says, Ani asiti shelot ishtakach Torah miYisrael. Says, I made it and ensured that the Torah will not be forgotten from the Jewish people. So the Gemara says, what did Rabbi Hayya do? Says, he went and he took seeds of flax and he planted the seeds. And after he planted the seeds, he waited till it grew. And he took the flax and he weaved it into a trap. Traps, to trap animals. After he made the trap, he trapped a deer. And he took the meat of the deer after he slaughtered it and fed it to the poor people. And then he took the parchment of that deer and he made cloth out of it from the leather. And he wrote 5 Sefer Torah on these parchments. And he studied with 5 students from these Hamashim. When the Beru HaKadosh heard this great feat, the Beru HaKadosh said, Kama gedolim ma'aseh hiya. How great are the deeds of hiya. What was the Beru HaKadosh getting all excited? Because he planted some flax? Because he was able to hunt down a deer? Or that he taught Humash? What was the hiya's greatness over here? That the bee was very very shocked and said, Kama gedolim ma'aseh hiya. And the explanation is that Rabbi Hayya understood that in order for Torah to be absorbed in the souls of the students and have a very, very great indelible impression, the more or the earlier in the process that you're able to imbue Kiddushah, the greater impact the Torah will have on the Talmid. Which means he understood that Of course you can go to the shelf and take any chumash off, as long as the words are correct, and start teaching it to the students, and it will have an impact. But you can't compare that to a chumash that already from the time of the traps that trapped the deer were already planted with kavanah. And the weaving of the trap itself was done with hilu, urhimu, urhimu, urhimu. And what? The deer itself was only trapped in order to give the meat to tzedakah. And as a byproduct, the leather was used for parchment written by the Hayyah himself. So therefore, those students, they had no idea. When they were sitting down learning from the Chumash, little did they know the investment that the Hayyah put into these Chumashim. And therefore, the Nabi said, "Kama gedolim ma'aseh Hayyah." Because the Hayyah understood that when the foundation is kadosh, when the foundation is solid, then already the power of influence and impact is that much greater. That's why Bezalel has been Uri ben Hur. Because only he that came from such a stock, and such a pedigree, a grandfather, he was able. The greatness of Bezalel wasn't in himself only. Already he descended from great ancestry. That already was the foundation of the building of the Mishkan. They say that when they built the Volozhin Yeshiva of Chaim Volozhin, they said at the groundbreaking, sort of Chaim was standing over the earth where they were going to lay the foundation, and he was crying. And they said, the witnesses, that there were so many tears that came down from the rabbi's eyes that on that day they didn't need water to mix the cement. It's from the rabbi's tears itself. Was enough. What was he crying? It was a momentous day. They're building a yeshiva. And the explanation is, Rav Chaim Volozhin understood that the Lashem Shamayim of the yeshiva doesn't start when the Rebbe walks into the shiur and starts to deliver the Gemara. He understood that when you're laying the bedrock in the ground, already it has to be placed with the right kavanot. It has to be placed with Yirat Shamayim. Because if that's compromised already, the building will not have the same ability to influence these students. Now, I have no doubt, if you look at the roster of graduates of the Volozhin Yeshiva, it's all stars. Each one's a bigger Rosh Yeshiva than the next. Now, no doubt, those students, when they entered the yeshiva, they were enjoying a tremendous amount of success and a tremendous amount of growth. They had no idea at that time that it's because of Chaim Volozhin in the foundation of the building were his tears of Yirat Shamayim and Kiddushah. So you see over here, if you want to have success in religion, you have to always make sure, as earlier in the stage, in the process that you can catch it, you have to sanctify it and make sure. Now, that doesn't mean to say that you cannot be influenced even in the Shelo L'Shem Shran, Gemara says, Metok Shelo L'Shma Ba L'Shma. But we're talking about over here on levels that once you try to be careful from the root. For that matter, it's brought down. The first Bet HaMikdash was destroyed, as you know. The second Bet HaMikdash was also destroyed. The Mishkan, however, was never destroyed. It went into Ginizah. It went into hiding somewhere. Why? The first Bet HaMikdash, as great as it was, but Hiram, the king of Tsur, was involved in the construction. So there was a snake. Can't last forever. The second Bet HaMikdash, Koresh, the king of Persia, also had a hand in it. Even though the Gemara says in Rosh Hashanah, Koresh Melech Kasher Haya. Koresh Otiyot Kasher. And still, he was involved with it. It cannot have endurance forever. The Mishkan, Moshe Rabbeinu, Bezalel, Aholiyav, only righteous Sadiqim, pure. This lasts forever. So you have to say, there is an Inyan to me. That's why somebody asked, when does Chinuch begin without children? When the kid's 2 years old, when he's 5 years old, first grade, second grade. So the rabbi said, the chinuch of our children begin 18 years before the child is born. Which means when you're in yeshiva, when you're in second grade, that's when your chinuch of your children begin. Because according to the level of your chinuch, that's going to be the level of the chinuch of your children. Which means we try to catch it at the original root. Our Torah says, when the ladies go to the mikveh, on the night of the mikveh, what's the kavanah that they have? That they should have Don Yesharim, that they should to conceive from such a night, they should have children going to be Tamidah HaKamim. They're talking about that, they haven't conceived yet, the bigger the war, which means already we catch it If a lady comes out of the mikveh, she sees a dog, go back to the mikveh. Why? Because then she saw a dog. It can impact if she conceives that night, and the child will be aznef. Amazing thing, which means our Torah is already worried about the child before his neshama is even dispatched down to the earth. That's already chinuch. And the earlier in the stage that you can catch this moment, that's why the gedolim, the children come out gedolim, because already they were working on themselves way before even their child came down into the world. And it makes a difference. That's the difference between people and people, on the preparation and the investment that was done at those embryonic stages or pre-embryonic stages. That being said, there's a pasuk. The pasuk says, maybe I have it in here just so I don't have to quote it by heart. Here's my note. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for coming this morning. And the pasuk says, "Vayis'u mirfidim, vayavou midbar Sinai, vayahanu b'midbar." Pasuk says, "Vayis'u mirfidim." They traveled from Rifidim, and they came to Midbar Sinai. So the Gemara says that ma bi'atan al minat lekabel Torah, af nesi'atan mirfidim lekabel Torah. Just like when they came to Har Sinai, they came to Har Sinai with one intent, to receive the Torah. So when they left the previous station at Nefidim, they also left with the intention to receive the Torah. The Gemara makes a point of that. So the rabbis ask, the Nesiv says, what are you pointing out of it? You want to tell me that they came to Har Sinai with the intention to receive the Torah? Good. You tell me that already from the last station stop when they left, one stop before, they left with the intention to receive the Torah. So the Nesiv points out that, again, the earlier they were able to sanctify their actions, the greater the impact the Ma'amad Har Sinai was. So it wasn't that when they got within 20 feet of the mountain, okay, already, you know, a couple of days before, when they were embarking to go to Har Sinai, their leaving was also what? With the Kavanah. So those steps that they took when they left their tents in Nefidim already influenced the way Matan Torah was going to be absorbed into their bones. You know, it's like, you know, there's certain people, you talk about, they go to Eretz Yisrael on a trip, the custom they go. So you ask people, you know, when do they start getting excited? So you have one guy, when the plane starts to fly over the Mediterranean, and he sees the Mediterranean from 36,000 feet, oh, his heart starts to skip a beat, the Amagadol, already, he's getting close. Other people, you know, not until till they land. They land in Ben Gurion, they get off the plane, they put their feet on the tarmac, in Israel, unbelievable. You know, other people, you know, not until they get into the taxi and they start seeing the Judean mountains and they start seeing, you know, Yerushalayim, welcome to Jews. Each person has a different, you know, a spot. Some guy, not until, you know, he gets to the Kotel for the first time, or, you know, he gets into a fight with the taxi driver, haggling with him. Each guy, the pizza, whatever his first point of excitement is. But there's some people that already, when they're leaving their house in New York, already they're getting the jitters already. The Shem Yehud, we're going to Eretz Yisrael, we're excited, which means, and that affects the level of power of Kiddushah that's going to go into them when they get there. Which means already they're dreaming 3 nights before the trip. They're already going to the mikveh. It's brought down in the books that some of the great hakamim, before they would give a shi'ur, they would go dip in the mikveh. Because the books bring down that, of course, Torah enters a person's heart no matter what. But if it's being given over by somebody that just immersed in the mikveh, it comes out differently and it pierces the heart of the listener. So a student sitting in the class, he's wondering, why am I being so elevated? Why am I being so... You think the rabbi just prepared? He didn't only prepare the curriculum. He also prepared himself. And therefore, the more we try to catch that moment of the beginning, as early as you can go in the process... Now again, I'm not telling you that we're going to go start planting flax and start trapping deers and things like that. You know, we have the Arts Kol Chumash already. You know, we have to rely on what we have, Baruch Hashem, that's doing its job. But the point is, there is something to say about this concept of the foundation. As a matter of fact, it says that when they made the clothes of Aharon HaKohen, we're reading about him in these parashiyot, Ve'asita bigdei kodesh le'aharon le'kadesho, to sanctify him. That means the clothes sanctified him. How does clothes sanctify you? You put on a suit, you feel kodesh? You put on a new tie, you feel holy? Of course not. This is a materialism. But the explanation is the clothes of the Kohen Gadol, they were not made by tailors or dressmakers or some sort of custom-made shop. The clothes of the Kohen Gadol were made by people that had to have kavanot in every stitch, the Shem Yahud, in every move of the pin, Vehi Noam, or all different Shemot. So when Aharon put on the Begadim, it was the Kadesho. The clothes themselves sanctified him. It wasn't enough just to go get, shelf goods. I gotta get me a size 38 long Hoshin. Get me a, Mikbat. What size is the hat? Sizes is just gotta get him a standard hat from the shelf. Of course not. This wouldn't have given Aharon the ability to succeed. It had to be customary by special people that prepared themselves. I've always said it. Look at the difference between our religion and the other religions of the world. We have our Bakashot that we sing every Friday night. The Bakashot are our songs. Who are these songs written by? First of all, look at the words of these songs. The words of these songs are all filled with mysticism, all filled with very deep Kabbalistic meanings, and they were all written by the greatest scholars of the time. When they wrote those songs, angels would be present listening to the lyrics and the music as they were singing. Like Yisrael Najara, for example, had angels at his table when he was singing the Bakashot, the songs that he wrote. Some of the songs were written by the Ibn Ezra. Kiyosh Mena Shabbat was written by the Ibn Ezra. Yassad Misodo was written by the Yosef Karo. Which means the greatest Tamidei Hachamim penned these songs. And when did they write it? When they came out of the Mikveh, after they finished, a certain elevation of spirit and soul. And that becomes our liturgical music. However, go to the Goyim, even on the Haldas. Who wrote these songs? Derelicts, degenerates, bumpkins. Who wrote these songs? Bing Crosby and Sinatra and Perry Como and all these guys that, their songs have become religious hymns. Who are they? Who are they? What are they? They weren't anything, they didn't write it, they wrote it when they were involved in their passion, and they wrote it when they were involved in their Yetzirah. They wrote it for money. That was their intent in order to make fame. And the words themselves are corrupt. And this has become and then you wonder why Am Yisrael is Kadosh. Everything that we have emanates from a proper source. That's why I have to be very careful. When you have the nouveau, the modernists that come in and they want to start introducing new things into our religion, we have to be very careful. Where do you originate from? What's your source? Where did you start from? Who's your starting point? And if the starting point is things that are not holy and things that are of compromise, you open up some of the books of the Stipler Rabbi and his son, and some of these books from Bnei Berak. It always bothers me. You open the book up, they tell you this book was written on paper that there's no hashash of Chilul Shabbat. You see, we didn't buy the paper from the Mead factory that works on Shabbat. We bought it from, we have the Itzkowitz paper, the black hat paper that the guy, hair from his beard is still in the book. You see it in the binding. And so they bought special religious, paper. Why? What's the difference? I'm buying for the paper, I'm buying for the words. The explanation, if you want the words to affect you, it's got to be written on paper that's also Kadosh. And you're right, if the paper's not Kadosh, does it still count? It still counts, but it's already tainted, it's diluted. That's how careful we have to be. With that, I'd like to answer a question. I know some of you are just getting over the holiday of Hanukkah, so I'll just say one word on Hanukkah. The guys that are, you son of Steve just put away his menorah last night.
I have mine in the
window. See that? So I know my customers. There's a, in the story of Hanukkah, which is right around the corner, the subject is like this. So we know basically the Hasmonaim, what they did with the oil. They had enough for one night, that lasted for 8 nights, the whole story. They took them 8 days to produce kosher oil. And they had to rely on a miracle. So the rabbis all ask the obvious question, what are you relying on a miracle for? The halakha says if there's tum'ah, and like we learned in the Gemara this week, if there's tum'ah all over, and the majority of the people are tameh, you're allowed to light the menorah even with tum'ah. So what are they were taking one night of oil, take regular oil that's tameh, put in the menorah, it's legal. It's legal. What were they making such a big stink over here that they had to come out to a miracle? This miracle was unnecessary. Go take regular oil that's defiled, put it in the menorah. Mutar or asur? Mutar. I didn't make up the salakah. This was not made up from the JTC, the Jewish Theological Conservative Seminary. This is written in the Gemara. So explanation is what? Why didn't they do it? So the Pnei Yeshua answer is amazing. Pnei Yeshua says, you're right. Under normal circumstances, you could use tameh oil in the Beit HaMikdash. And under normal circumstances, you can bring the Korban Pesach b'tum'ah. But this was different, because it just wasn't any other day. This was the re-inauguration of the Beit HaMikdash. We were starting the Beit HaMikdash again from scratch. At the inauguration, at the foundation ceremonies, there is no compromise. At the foundation, it cannot be, we had a loophole. There's no loopholes at the foundation. If the foundation is done 100% with all the letter of the laws, then already you have a chance. Now, once the Beit HaMikdash is functional, there comes a day where everybody's tameh, okay, so make an exception on tameh. But Hanukkah was a rededication ceremony. On rededication, it has to be tahor. Hence, the Mishkan was done by none other than Bezalel ben Uri ben Hur. A lesson in educating our children, how careful we have to be with the environment and the, who we let them learn with, where they let them learn, you know, from who, from what, with the books, with the curriculum, all these things definitely have we're putting our children either at an advantage or a disadvantage, the way we guide them. Our Torah goes on to tell us about the donations that were generously given for the Mishkan. Vayavu ha'anashim al anashim. The rabbis say that the ladies came before the men. Vayavoa anashim al anashim, which means the anashim came after the ladies, which means online to give donations, the ladies went first. That's truly an amazing thing, that the ladies were even more generous in giving their jewelry, it says. It says, what did they give? Hachvadizim, tabat v'chumaz, kokli zahav. All their ornaments. So I saw from one of the rabbis, this is not the first time the ladies were asked to donate their jewelry. If you remember in last week's parasha, when they came to Aharon to build the Egel, so he had a stalling tactic. Aharon's tactic was, go home, bring me your wife's earrings, and then we'll put it together and make an Egel. Aharon, of course, knowing the nature of ladies, that they're not going to part with their jewelry that fast, and they're going to get into a fight with their husbands, and they're back and forth, they give me a jewelry, I'm not giving it to them. In the meantime, Moshe Rabbeinu will surface again. Sure enough, when the husbands came home, give me a jewelry, they're not getting our jewelry, I don't know where it is, you're not getting it, they gave the excuse. And in the end, it sort of backfired, because the men themselves gave their own gold for the Egel. The question is asked, what was the motivation of those ladies not to give their gold? Not to give their jewelry. Well, it can be one of two things. Either because a lady is attached to their jewelry. It doesn't do a religiously motivated kavanah. That's it. You know, jewelry is jewelry. We're not giving you the jewelry. It's a precious asset or commodity to a lady. Therefore, she's not willing to give it up so fast. Or was it religiously motivated? Or did they come with a hashkafic argument? How could we give jewelry to serve idolatry, to paganism, and to... Was it religiously motivated, or was it selfishly motivated? The truth is, from the story in Parashat Ki Tisah, you don't know. But when do you know? In this week's Parashah. When it came to the voluntary collection of donations, and the ladies went even faster than the men, and they willingly gave their jewelry, that already exposed to us what their kavanah was when they did not give their jewelry at the Egel. And therefore the ladies were rewarded with a special holiday. That would be the holiday of Rosh Chodesh, which was originally given to the men as a holiday. but taken away after we did the Egel, and they got to celebrate it. Some ladies have the custom not to work on Rosh Chodesh. Our ladies don't work the whole month, Gezerah, that they might work on Rosh Chodesh. but the point is, right, you know, Atu, you know, that's, make a fence around the whole thing. In any event, the lesson being is that the ladies are really idealistically motivated for the right reasons. I know it's not a ladies' class, but if anybody thinks that our Torah is chas v'shalom prejudice or biased to ladies, you know, because they think that the Torah is chauvinistic, chas v'shalom, you see the exact opposite. You see over here the Torah is giving credits that the ladies were even more generous than the men. When it came to the Egel, the ladies were better than the men. When it came to the spies, it says the men cried about Eretz Yisrael, the ladies didn't. When it came to Sarah, she was a bigger prophet than son of Abraham. Rivka had vision that Yitzhak Avinu didn't have. When it came to going out of Egypt, the Gevarazos Bezchut Nashim Tzadkaniyot, the Galu Avotenu, the Mitzrayim. So the Torah is replete with examples of the power of the Jewish lady. I once read from Chaim Baruch, what does it mean, Bezchut Nashim Tzadkaniyot, the Galu Avotenu, the Mitzrayim? What was the Zechut of the Jewish woman? The simple explanation is we know, because the men had given up hope already. They did not want to have any more children. They said, Nashav Anu Amedim, what are we bringing children into a world that they're going to be enslaved? So they decided not to have any children. Birth control. The woman came to their husband and said, listen, one day we're going to be redeemed. And if we don't have children, there's not going to be any generation to stand at Yam Suf when we are finally delivered. And they coaxed their husbands, and they spoke to them words of faith and betachon, and sure enough, they were able to procreate. The Gemara says it clearly. If it wasn't for the ladies, there would have been no Exodus. I mean, there would have been an Exodus. There would have been no people at the Exodus. The sea would have split, and it just would have been, a wasted event. So therefore, the ladies get the credit. That's why ladies are hayab on the holiday of all the mitzvot. So when the Chambaruch used to say a different explanation. A joke. The Jews were supposed to be in Egypt for 400 years. So we got out at 210, 190 years early, which means we were saved from 190 years of what jarred us. Where did we get saved? So it says, the ladies came to God and said, don't worry, we'll give the men so much what jarred us, it'll make up 190 years. So it says, that might be the pshat, incidentally. In any event, that's what it means in the Torah when it says the ladies came even before the men. Furthermore, in our parasha, after the meeting was over, Moshe Rabbeinu had gathered all the people together. The pasuk says that he inspired them, we have to make the Mishkan, we've got to collect the money, etc., etc. Pasuk Chaf says, Vayitzu kol adat b'nei Yisrael b'lifnei Moshe. It says that all the Jewish people, after the meeting was over, they left from Moshe. So the Eliyahu Lapian asked the obvious question. We know that the meeting was convened by Moshe, and he was talking at the meeting. When the meeting was over, they left. Goes without saying that they left from Moshe. Why does Pasuk have to say "Vayetzeu kol adat b'nei Yisrael milifnei Moshe"? Obviously, they were in front of Moshe. So Rabbi Eliyahu Lapian says a very important lesson that when you see a person on the street walking, just by looking at him, it's discernible where he just came from. For example, you see a person walking with a gym bag in his hand and sneakers, and he's breathing a little heavily. You know, he just came from a workout. He just came from the gym. You don't have to ask him even. You know already it's evident. When you see a person staggering in the street, you know, he's taking three steps forwards, and he makes three steps forward, say shalom. He makes three steps backwards, and he's yahogu v'yanu kashikor. He's weeble wobbling. So you know, he just came from a bar. He just came from a saloon. He's drunk. It's evident from where he comes from. So the rabbi said, so too when a person comes from a Torah class. When a person comes to a Torah class, it should be evident when he's walking in the street that what? Where he came from just by looking at him. You see a guy rubbing his eyes, and he just came from a Torah class. He just woke up. Of course not. Which means when a person comes out of a Torah class, obviously his demeanor is different, his behavior is different, his attitude is different. You don't come out of a class, and the guy's screaming in the streets, and the guy takes off his yarmulke, and he's doing all sorts of things. So it's not evident. It has to be evident, not in the class that you're in the class. When you're out of the class, that what? That you just came from where? You were learning with the rabbis. And that's what the Pasuk says over here. When they left, it was evident that they just left Melefnei Moshe. Which means when you saw them walking in the streets, oh, these guys just came from class. How could you tell? Look at them. Awadim, they're walking, they're talking properly, everybody's judging each other favorably.
You must just, not talking
No one talking Lashon Hara, no one talking in a boisterous manner. Therefore, there's no secret to have a proper Torah attitude in the Shi'ur. When you leave, it has to be clear to all where you just came from. This week we read Parashat HaChodesh, special Shabbat. Parashat HaChodesh, you read HaChodesh Hazeh Lachem Rosh Chodashim Rishon Hu Lachem Chodshei Hashana. We're told about the Jewish calendar that it's a lunar calendar as opposed to the calendar of the Goyim that is a solar calendar. Basically a solar calendar has 365 days, lunar calendar 354 days. That's why every year there's an 11 day discrepancy between the two calendars. And therefore, we must make an adjustment from time to time, which is called a leap year. If you don't make a leap year, which means in 3 years already, we're 30 days behind. So that means Pesach will come out March 1st. In 6 years, Pesach will start to come out in February. All of a sudden, you'll have, instead of having Hanukkah in December, you're going to have Pesach in December. That's ruin all the Passover trips. You know, you can't... In any event... So Pesach has to come out in the spring. That's the halakha. In order to keep the Pesach in the spring, so you have to constantly have an adjustment from time to time to add 30 days to the calendar. That's why we have a second Adar. So our calendar is a lunar calendar with a solar adjustment. The Arabs, for example, they have a pure lunar calendar. Lunatics with a lunar calendar, which means they don't adjust it at all. They just, that's why Ramadan comes out every year at a different time. Sometimes it comes out in the summer, sometimes it comes out in the spring, sometimes it comes in the fall. That was too complicated for them to make the adjustment. In any event, the question would be, why do we follow a lunar calendar? Why do the Goyim follow a solar calendar? It is clear that sun represents the Gentiles, the Goyim, not only according to their calendar, but according to what the sun represents. It's might, it's strong, it's power. And the Jew is represented by the moon, and the moon waxes and wanes. The Jewish people are, it's never consistent. Sometimes they're full, sometimes they're lacking, sometimes they're growing, sometimes they're falling. Obviously, at least in the exile, is compared to the moon. One day it's going to reverse. B'nai Yisrael is going to shine like the sun. But as it is now, that's the representation. What's the significance of this? Furthermore, right after God tells them about the sun and the moon, God tells them about the laws of Korban Pesach. God tells the Jewish nation, take for yourself a sheep, tie it to your bedpost, circumcise yourself, slaughter the Korban Pesach, take its blood and sprinkle it on your doorposts, roast the Korban Pesach, eat the Korban Pesach in your homes, close the door, don't leave your house. It has to be eaten only with your families, the Mishpachotam. Any non-circumcised man cannot eat. Any stranger cannot eat. What's the connection between the calendar, sun and moon, and the laws of Korban Pesach? I mean, the Torah is juxtaposing them together. That's tomorrow's reading, by the way. So the explanation is as follows. Says the Be'er Yosef. He says like this. The Jewish people were in Egypt. They became so homogenized with the Egyptian culture that you were not able to tell the difference between a Jew and an Egyptian. It makes sense. You live there for 210 years, you're going to get influence. You're going to get assimilated. To the extent the Pasuk says, O Hanisa Elohim Nakahat O Goy, Mekerev Goy. It was a goy within a goy. Not an am within a goy. A goy from a goy. Halal of the Avodah Zarah. Halal of the Avodah Zarah. Even the heavenly court could not justify why we were leaving Egypt. They don't deserve it. Which means these are idolaters, these are idolaters. The Midrash says, Halalu Megadle Blorit, Halalu Megadle Blorit. Which means even the haircuts, you know, the fashion, the Egyptians had a certain type of haircut, the Jews also, you know, had the same type of haircut. They were influenced. So one of the rabbis explained like this. It was goy mekerev goy, a goy within a goy. A goy within a goy is like a lady that's pregnant. Pregnancy is also, you have a baby within a, you have a human within a human. Right? Goy mekerev goy. That means, when you have an embryo that's in a body, you have let's say a mother, it's attached, it's one with the body. It's one with the mother. Now, a doctor can't just come along and pull the baby out. Sakana. The baby has to slowly start to detach itself, and then already the doctor can help pull it out. The doctor can't come in the ninth month before even any labor pains, before the baby starts to turn, and just yank the baby out. Sakana for everybody. The Jewish people were goy mekerev goy. They were a nation. We were in the Egyptians' belly, meaning we were attached. So God couldn't just come and yank us out. Doesn't work that way. It's got to have the labor pains. You have to have a process. So what was the process? The process begins, first of all, Mishichu ukolachem son. Mishichu, pull for yourselves a sheep. The Gemara says, Mishichu atzmechem avodah zarah. Pull yourselves, don't pull the sheep, pull yourselves away from the idolatry. Until that point, the Egyptians worshipped the sheep. You know who else worshipped the sheep? The Jews. There were Jews worshipping the sheep. Yeah, come on, how is it possible? Go to India today, they're still worshipping the cow. Today you walk in the streets of India, there's people walking in the streets and cows walking in the streets. Cows have not equal rights. Right. The cow has the right of way. Meaning you're at a, you know, please yield to cows, not the pedestrians. The cow, it's an amazing thing. You kill a cow in India, capital punishment. Finish. Sekila, sit if I had put you in jail. This is the worst avon you could do. So there's still people today that are worshipping the animals. So in those days, in Egypt, they worshipped the sheep. Amisel also got sucked into this avodah zarah. What does God say? We got to start the labor process. So the first thing we got to do is we got to start taking the clutches off the Egypt. Got to pull you out. Got to extract you. So what's the first thing to do? You got to take a sheep and you got to slaughter it. That's already going to break your connection with the Egyptians from avodah zarah. But there's a problem. You look like the Egyptians. These guys are not circumcised. You're not circumcised. Okay, you can't eat the Korban Pesach until you circumcise yourself. So that was another labor pain. Pulling you out. Okay. Now what? This Korban Pesach, you have to roast it. What's going to happen? The Egyptians are going to come along and say, wow. You know, the moderate Egyptians are going to smell it. They're going to say, now what? Forget about Avodah Zarah. Let's have dinner. There's a barbecue over here. So they might come to the Jewish people and say, you know, let's give us some of this meat over here. Especially it says that the fragrance of Gan Eden was in the meat. So what does Borei Olam tell the Jews? Kol ben nechal lo yechal bo. This meat over here you can't eat. There's no socializing with them in this meal. You socialize with them enough for 210 years. Go eat this in your house. You know what you got to do in your house? You got to close the door. Which means God was slowly separating the Jew from the Egyptian. So what's going to happen? The Egyptian is going to come to knock on the door. He's going to eat with us. You know, he's going to want to have some of the meat. What's going to end up happening? He's going to come to our door. He's going to see the blood of his Avodah Zarah smeared on our doorposts. The Be'er Yosef says that's going to shock the Egyptians. They're going to become so mortified that we defile their idolatry in such a way, they're going to run away. It's like a scare tactic. And therefore, what was the whole lesson of Korban Pesach? Separate from the goyim. Extract yourself. Don't dress like them. Your body shouldn't look like them. Don't eat with them. Do not serve with them. Do not follow them. And that's the lesson also of the sun and the moon. The sun represents the goyim. The moon represents the Jews, as I explained. Now let me tell you something about the lunar cycle. Of course the sun doesn't move. You know that already. It's the moon that's orbiting around the sun. Based on its position, That's what we see from Earth. Sometimes a full moon, sometimes a half moon, sometimes a quarter moon, sometimes no moon. Now, the further the moon is away from the sun, the more light it reflects from the sun, and the bigger moon we see from our vantage. Now, as it's making its orbit, the closer it gets to the sun, the darker the moon is on our vantage. Lesson being very clear. The closer the Jew gets to the society, to the culture, he thinks it's considered, he's getting enlightened. Oh, society. We're going to go to their colleges, we're going to go to their theaters, we're going to go to their philharmonics, and the society, and their museums, and to their restaurants, and high class, and they're going to certainly become, you know, sophisticated people. And the Torah is telling you, the closer the moon gets to the sun, the darker the moon gets. And the further away the moon comes from the sun, the lighter it is. And therefore, if I'm Yisrael is to shine and to have radiance, it's only when we are separate. So God introduces the laws of Korban Pesach. What's the laws of Korban Pesach? Separate yourselves. So how does it start off? First of all, let me teach you about the calendar. You're the sun, you're the moon. This is how it works. Once you understand philosophically the sun and the moon, now do it in principle. Now separate yourselves physically. Now, if this was important 2,000 or 3,000 years ago, it's certainly important today in our time. Why? In our time, we're also living amongst the Goyim. We're living in America now, our community, for close to 100 years, maybe a little more than 100 years, that our community has been on these shores. Now, 100 years is a long time. And it's clear that we are a minority of a minority, living amongst millions of goyim and secularized Jews. As a result of that, our great rabbis many years ago, including the chief rabbi, specifically the chief rabbi Chaim Yaakov Katzin, Alav Shalom, saw the need to create a fence. Because he knew that it's very possible that our community will start to intermarry. Now, of course, they would intermarry with a legal loophole, conversion. They will take a girl, you know, Italian girl or Puerto Rican or Mexican, whatever it is, and we'll bring it to the rabbi, and you know, she'll say, I want to be Jewish. And why do you want to be Jewish? Because I love Jews, I always love Jews. And she'll give some type of fake story, you know, I want to do all the mitzvot, and I always wanted to eat kosher, I always wanted to go to the mikveh, I always wanted to fast on Kippur, you know, all these things that are fun. And she'll convert, and for the wrong reasons, of course, and then you'll have a community that will be all riz ufasulye, which means it'll be all a hoshbosh, all a mixture of hybrids, non-Jews, Jews, and it'll be all the best, and we're not going to know who anybody is. You don't need to go so far, just go a little outside our community, and you see exactly the damage that converts have caused on Jewish communities, the havoc that they have caused, because a lot of them are not legal. There are a lot of fake rabbis that convert them without the proper documents. Just look what's going on in Florida recently. They had a big meeting, the liberal rabbis of Miami, and they just lowered the standards of conversions. And to us, we laugh at these meetings, because to us we said, it doesn't affect us. This is we got an edict. We have the edict, which means we wouldn't even know what the word edict meant. If I were to ask you what an edict is, most people in the community think edict is a letter that bans converts. It's not so. Edict is a document. But to us, in the word edict, we think one thing. No converts. Now, as a result of it, we're not subject to any of these liberal rabbis that want to convert, all the politics surrounding it. In Florida, the chief rabbi of Israel had to fly down and make a rabbinical council meeting, the Diplomat Hotel, 200 rabbis, trying to tighten the bolts and screws because the conversion went wild out there. Look at the messes they're having over there. Nobody knows who anybody is. Nobody knows who's Jewish, who's not Jewish, who's legal, who's not legal. Baruch Hashem, Hacham Yaakov and the rabbis 60-70 years ago, they saw the need to put a fence. They weren't saying don't convert. Convert, just not here or somewhere else. You can't go to our schools, you can't pray with us. As I've said many times, it was a stroke of prophecy, it was a stroke of genius, that they were able to see exactly how important this is. And this has really safeguarded our community. This edict, incidentally, has been accepted by all factions of our community and all persuasions. As a matter of fact, in the 1984, I think it was, some members, laymen of the community, righteous members of the community, sought fit to reaffirm this declaration and this edict, and especially the community had grown and many new institutions had emerged, and they brought the presidents of every institution and their rabbis, and they had it signed again at a big breakfast in Shaare Tzion. It was a beautiful event where all the members had signed it, and again it was hung up, framed, and hung up proudly in every synagogue. I am a little concerned that in my lifetime I never thought that we would see somebody even attempt to question that edict. The edict is Kodesh Kodeshim in our community. This is something that we pride ourselves. Exactly, this is our crown. This is something that, you know, it's uniquely ours, and we look at the results of it, and the proof is, you know, the proof is there. You don't have to look far to see what the result is. The result is this community, where it is the only community in the world that is safely protected from intruders and from falsifiers and from questionable people. However, the trend of modernism, like I said, in my lifetime I never thought I would see that people would start to begin second guessing or questioning the validity or the properness of such an edict. Unfortunately, today in the community there is a undercurrent, I'll call it now. Of course, I'm trying to come to you months before. I'm not trying to come to you after the problem. I like to present you a problem before you're going to read it in the newspapers. So you say, oh, Rabbi Mansell talked about it a year ago, he predicted it. Well, I told you, if you remember, I'm not happy that I made this prediction. I told you 2 years ago, when the Eruv was put up in Brooklyn, and that was against the will of Rabbi Kassim, who clearly wrote, in the few things that he wrote in his life regarding this community, he wrote that he was not pro-Eruv. They went against that paper of Chaim Yaakov, and they said, nah, times change, different, this, that, and they disregarded it. Now, maybe times did change, and maybe things are different, but a precedent was set that not everything that is written by the great chief rabbi necessarily needs to be upheld. Well, once there's a hole in the fence, so then already you could tear down the entire fence. And I predicted that, well, once this document of Achem Yaakov has been disregarded, we have to now be very careful that this second document called the edict is also going to become diluted and compromised. And unfortunately, we are now seeing a sentiment of people in the community, and I'm sorry to say even leaders, and maybe even some rabbinic leaders in our community, that are becoming a little wishy-washy on the necessity of having such an edict. Just last week, in our community, a Puerto Rican was accepted into one of the congregations in New Jersey. And the rabbi got up and said, we'd like to welcome them to the congregation. And their children were given aliyot and kai on purpose to show that we accept them. This lady, Puerto Rican lady, of course she's not from our community, she's from Puerto Rico, from San Juan. I don't know where she came from.
Not from the Passover trip.
I know that. Not from the, maybe she worked on the Passover trip.
Whatever.
But the point is.
But I gotta ask what shul.
What shul? Go find out. We'll tell you what shul it is. No, it's not obvious. It's not obvious. But the. So what's going on over here? What's going on over here? So you see already. Now, of course, there are a significant amount of rabbis that will say, yeah, why not? You know? So what's going on over here? Now already there's been a breach and there's been a hole in this fence. Now, if we're going to have Puerto Rican converts sitting in our ladies' section next to our mothers and daughters, and we're going to have children of these people associating with us and getting aliyot, you're all vulnerable. The sakana is very grave. The sakana is very, very... We are in very great danger. Not you, Baruch Hashem, you're married. But you all have children, you have grandchildren. We have enough hard time sifting out from the Jewish people the right families and the wrong families and the good people and the less than good people and the honorable people and the less than honorable people. Now, if we don't do something to tighten up the bolts of this document, then we are going to be in great, grave danger. But of course, the modern free thinker doesn't usually have the ability to foresee consequences. These people live in the present, and they want to show, we made it mutar, we showed. They think that it's a big chokmah to say everything is mutar. And they are single-handedly dismantling a very important mechanism. If it was up to me, I would vote that we have to reaffirm this document once again. This was done 20 years ago. Since that time, many institutions have emerged. Many new leaders have emerged as well. And the document might be vague. I wouldn't want my great-grandchild reading the document and saying, well, maybe it meant this, maybe it meant that. It has to be written again. It has to be clarified. It has to be signed. And we have to root out any weakness in the rabbinate. And that would be a good time to know where everybody stands. Who doesn't sign this time around? Then we'll be able to root out these rotten weeds that are definitely going to jeopardize the security and the kiddushah and the purity of our community. So I think it's a very, very pressing issue. If that was able to happen, I never thought in my lifetime we would hear such a story, at least on converts. Because that was our, that's taboo to us. That's something that we hold sacred. But once already there's a breach in the fence, not only do we have to put up a new fence, but we have to put up six more fences behind it, and we have to cement it, and we have to put steel and barricade bars in order that nobody else can break it. We have to be alarmed at the beginning of the crisis. Not after already it's rampant and we're starting to give out penicillin and all sorts of, to inoculate. It's too late already. We're trying to catch it like the bird flu. You're trying to catch it when a couple of chickens come down with a disease, so you kill 4 million chickens just so it doesn't spread. And we're at the beginning of now, I would say, an epidemic that Chas v'Shalom, if it's left unchecked and left unwatched, Chas v'Shalom, it can spread, and then already, who loses out? The people, the community loses out. And then already, our children and our community become just like every other community in the world, where we don't know anybody, where there's infiltration, where there's Chas v'Shalom non-purity at the weddings, as was mentioned. And therefore, in this parashah, it says, Am Yisrael was told, slaughter the Pesach. Slaughtering the Pesach wasn't merely a ritual. Slaughtering the Pesach was separate yourselves from the ways of the Goyim, from their practices, from their look. You have to circumcise yourself from socializing, close the door. They cannot eat from the Korban Pesach. And only when we were able to separate, that was the labor pains. Now God said, okay, the baby has turned. Now already you can emerge. Now already you can leave Egypt. And that's why we count the lunar calendar. Because the further we stay away, the lighter we are. But the closer we get, the darker we are. And therefore, these fences only bring light to the Jewish nation. When they were in their dwellings, then there's or. But once they leave that encampment, then already there's darkness. We have enough hardship with our kids going to the yeshiva and being brought up in beautiful homes. We have a hardship raising them in the proper way. We don't need any more challenges and difficulties in insulating and protecting our children. In any event, Be'ezat Hashem, if Hashem daber al ozen shoma'at, fortunate is the man that speaks on people that have ears, that are able to listen correctly. If there's a talk already, even in the community, I mentioned this in the ladies' class on Thursday, and I'm committed to mention it again in several other classes, because if it's not addressed, it's going to be serious. So you should repeat it. Yes, Rabbi Menzel talked about converts, and you could say he was very strict about it. And according to my opinion, there should be no exceptions to the rule. Even though there's casualties. I agree there's casualties. Now what about some kind of tzaddikah? Yes, unfortunately, when you make takanot, there are going to be casualties. But those casualties are worth the majority. When you go to war, there's also casualties of war. But what? Those casualties, you have to say, are justified because it brings the ultimate peace. So you feel bad for those cases. A guy moved into the community, Hazid, Sadiq, the guy's get Sadiq and all that, and we don't let him pray. We feel very bad. We feel terrible about it. But you know what? This is the takana we have. This is the rules we have. We have a certain standard that has protected us for so many years, and therefore, if it was up to me, there would be no exceptions. That being said, I understand Hacham Yaakov did make a few exceptions. Hacham Baruch Alav Hashalom did make a few exceptions. The only difference was they were considered gatekeepers. Now, a gatekeeper who's a responsible gatekeeper can make an exception who they want to let in because they're responsible, they're a gatekeeper, and therefore if they investigate, they say this will not pose a threat and therefore you can let somebody in. However, today we have no gatekeeper. Today already it's open, which means the gatekeepers are gone. When Chaim Baruch died, alav shalom, that was the last gatekeeper. Now already, Isha Yashar Ben Avi Aseh. Each guy nominates himself as the gatekeeper of the community. So now we got 50 guys standing at the gate. So you go to the first guy. Can I get in? No, Hashem. Oh, okay, next guy. Can I get in? No, Hashem. Go to the third guy. But no, of course you go in. I'll help you go in. Which means today's already confusion. There's no more gatekeeper. Everybody assigned themselves as Rosh. Each guy in his own community. I have my own standard. What do you mean my own standard? We never have your own standard. We have a community standard. There's in the banking industry, there's a certain standard. In the garment industry, there's a certain standard. A guy can't come along and say, well, I'm creating a new standard. What do you mean? You have to follow the certain standard of quality. Our community has a standard. Each rabbi in his individual shul cannot come along and say, I don't hold of it. I have a different understanding. Hold it. Once you took a job to work as a rabbi in this community, it's automatically assumed in your contract that you are going to uphold the custom and the tradition of the community at large. Yeah, you want to give a class on Gemara, you want to give a class on Navi? All right, we don't have a charter on that. But we do have a charter on not accepting converts. And therefore, unless you can agree to such an edict, you cannot have a position in this community. Because a position as such will jeopardize the future. Because all our communities are intermingled. And we have a cousin that prays in that shul, we have an uncle that prays in the other synagogue. All our community, as split up as it is, there's still back and forth between the synagogues. There's still a certain amount of camaraderie between the synagogues. And therefore, when it comes to these things, there must be unity. Again, it is, I'm talking like a big shot, it's my opinion. No one listens to my opinion anyway. I'm some guy talking to a bunch of 23 guys in a midrash over here, in the middle of nowhere. And you have the big shots and all the big synagogues over here. And they're the ones that obviously are going to be the deciders and the movers and the shakers. But I'm telling you over here that we have definitely something to be concerned about. Because once that happened in our community, and where's the uproar? Who alerted me to this? I'm thrilled. Girls from Deal that pray in the shul, they called me up. Not religious even, meaning regular mainstream. These are not, they don't have wigs and hats and wigs. These are regular mainstream people. They said, Rabbi, what's going on in our community? For years, these people were shunned. Now already they accepted them. It's making a fuss out of the rabbinate. Well, the rabbis chasing. What happened? Somebody got bribed? Oh, because the guy's a rich man. He's building the shul. He made a big check. Now already with Matir Asurim. Oh, look what it's doing now. Now this can undermine the whole trust that the community has in its hakamim. When they see double standard and they see a hypocrisy and they see two sets of measures and two sets of weights. For you it's no good, for you it's good. You're kasher, you're pasul. Therefore, we have to be very, very concerned and careful that these reckless drivers, these blind gatekeepers, do not ruin it for everybody else that wants to live according to the tradition. Shabbat shalom, barach.